A young couple had been married for about a year or so, and they were struggling financially, like many young couples do in those early days. So they decided to do something about it. They developed a strategy. They sat down one day to talk about their finances, and the wife said to her husband, "If we miss two payments on the fridge and one payment on the new washing machine, we'll have enough money to put down as a deposit for a new smart TV." It's human nature, isn't it? It's what we do. We just can't help getting ourselves into a mess. And that's what we saw as we began our Bible overview, a wonderful creation, but a fallen humanity who chose to rebel against our good and our holy God. But last week we were told that God promised to bless all nations of the world through his people. How's that going to happen? Well, here in Exodus we see two parallel stories, if you like. Or we see a story that parallels with something else that we know, we look ahead to. How we see how God saves his Old Testament people. But through that, we're given a picture of how God is going to save his New Testament people and bless them, you and I. The big idea that I want us to get hold of today is that our God is a God who rescues. And the first point that we pick up is that God saves people who cannot save themselves. I don't know about you, but over the last week I've been reading story after story about folks in the Ukraine being saved from the terrible situation by other people. Children with learning difficulties being taken by their carers to the border in a bus. I've read about an Irish medical student whose parents contacted some blokes in Ukraine who then travelled to the city where she was stranded and brought her home. I read about a Sky News team caught in an ambush, wounded and stranded, saved by local men, and then hours of waiting, taken to safety by the police. Just the tip of the iceberg of those stories. And God is the ultimate rescuer of people who cannot save themselves. When we read Exodus, like most of the Old Testament, we can't just read it, well, like any of the Old Testament, we can't read it in isolation as just a sort of a nice or an interesting story. Rather, we have to see how it points us forward to the New Testament. And here in these events, we see a picture, an illustration of how God is going to save you and me through Jesus. And we're going to look at that over the next couple of weeks. See, you and I are trapped too. We're trapped in our sin. What's it like? Well, the Bible tells us what being trapped by sin is like. It's like being the Old Testament people of God in Egypt, enslaved by a cruel tyrant. Haven't you thought to yourself, I don't know why these people in Ukraine left it so long. I'd have got out there a lot sooner. But would you? Leaving in time would have meant quitting your job when things still seemed okay. It would have meant writing off all of your savings in your bank account, abandoning your home, defaulting on your mortgage payments so that you had no home to come back to. It would have meant leaving behind everything you'd worked hard to achieve. All of your possessions, your car, your technology, your clothing, your food, your medication, as well as everything that belonged to the rest of your family. It would mean walking out into the winter weather, which is harsher than our winter weather that we've experienced this year, with no idea where you would go or where you would live. Or what you would survive on, with nothing more than a small suitcase of clothes and essentials and a few banknotes in your wallet. Are you still sure you would have left? That's a big decision to make. No wonder people found themselves trapped. And sin traps and enslaves us too. Letting go of our independence and submitting totally to God appears reckless, foolish, impossible. It looks as though we have to give up too much that we rely on for security. In reality, sin tricks us into staying put until it's too late. Or into being like the young couple in the story at the beginning. Not really free, not really safe. And we're not really free and safe with sin as our master. We're simply digging ourselves further and further into trouble as we get more and more entangled into sin's debt. course, the Hebrew people had once been free, hadn't they? They'd been free in Egypt. But as time went on, they became more of a problem to the Egyptians. Abraham's children had multiplied and grown through God's providence. They'd escaped famine by Joseph's, albeit tortuous, route to power in Egypt, which God oversaw. In God's power, Joseph had saved the Egyptians from famine and been able to bring his family to Egypt and save them from famine, so God's people were rescued. But now, 400 years later, Joseph's diligence has been forgotten. And these Hebrews, these refugees, they've become inconvenient to the Egyptians. It's a lesson for the nations of the West, isn't it? As all the Ukrainians flood in and we rejoice and receive them, that they're safe. We've not got to forget that. We've not got to become like the Egyptians. Now the descendants of one family to the Egyptians are too many. Their culture is having an impact on Egyptian culture. Their language is creeping into daily use. They're taking the Egyptians' jobs. They're no longer welcome in their country. And so the Hebrews have been subjugated. They've been made slaves of the Egyptians. They are an oppressed people, suffering terrible, inhumane crimes. So cruel is Pharaoh that he decided to wipe out an entire generation of God's people, putting all the baby boys to death. Like Putin, civilians are fair game to Pharaoh. The Hebrews are trapped. But even if they had left when they were able to, where would they go? They had no land that was actually their own. And so, like the Ukrainians trapped by an advancing hostile army, like us in our sin leading to death, God's people were enslaved and trapped and unable to save themselves. But that doesn't mean that they were unable to be saved. All of this might sound like a disaster, but remember last week, God had made a promise to Abraham, a promise to bless the whole world through his family, and nothing derails God's promises, not even despotic tyrants. So we're told in verses 22 to 25 of Exodus 2, during that long period, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. And it doesn't just sort of disappear into the ether. God hears. God is not indifferent. In situations of suffering, the common question is asked, isn't it? Does God care? Well, these verses plainly tell us that God heard their groaning and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Now, of course, one of the complaints about the West in the current situation with Ukraine is that we hear their cries for help, but we don't seem to be doing enough. Here in our verses for today, we see that God acts. He saves people who cannot save themselves. But he seems to save in an odd way, because God chooses Moses. And Moses is a very weak individual to work his message of salvation through. Let me remind you. See, Moses should have died with the other Hebrew baby boys, but his mother put him in that basket, covered it with pitch, with tar, so that it didn't sink. She floated him down the River Nile. In God's providence, Pharaoh's daughter, who was bathing in the Nile, sort of spotted the baby in the basket, went all kind of gooey about the little baby, and oh, isn't he sweet? But didn't actually want all that hassle of waking up at 4 a.m. in the morning and having to look after him. So, recruited unknowingly, Moses' mother to raise him. So Moses was raised a Hebrew, but in the palace of Pharaoh. Then one day, Moses saw an Egyptian slave driver beating a Hebrew. And he was incensed, so much so that he actually ended up murdering the Egyptian. And he buried his body in a shallow grave. The next day, Moses took a couple of squabbling Hebrews to task. You know, why don't fight amongst ourselves? Oh yeah, they said. What you going to do about it? Bump us off like you did that Egyptian? And Moses realized that his crime hadn't gone unnoticed. And he was in trouble. So he ran away to a country called Midian. And he lived the quiet life as a farmer, as a shepherd. But frankly, as a fugitive. Now 80 years old. Moses is comfortable in his life. until he encountered a bush on fire in the desert. And it's not uncommon that, because it can be so hot and the bush can be so dry. But this bush didn't burn up, and that is uncommon. And from the bush, God spoke to Moses and announced his name. We hear in this passage the name of God. I am. Or as it was translated into Hebrew, Yahweh, or Jehovah. Or in our Bibles, Lord in capital letters. So when you see Lord in capital letters in our Bible, it's the name of God. It's I am, it's Yahweh. And we discover that Yahweh has a job for Moses. You see, God has heard the cries of his people, and so he sends Moses to be his spokesman to tell Pharaoh that God is going to lead his people to freedom. But here's the problem. Moses is a wanted man in Egypt. He's 80. He has a family, a good job, nice home, and to be honest, he really doesn't feel up to the job of being a public speaker. Thank you very much, God. It's very kind of you to offer me the job, but no thanks. That's Moses' response. Here's the thing. God wasn't asking. God was telling. Moses looks like a terrible way for God to save his people. One weak human being to rescue a whole people from a tyrant. Surely the best solution is to send in a crack SAS squad to bump off Pharaoh. Not a retired shepherd in his 80s with a dodgy past. But we're reminded here that the way God has saved us from the slavery of sin is a way that seems foolish and weak to many. God, mighty, sovereign, powerful, became a man. Jesus, a tiny baby, born into poverty in Bethlehem, under a tyrannical ruler, he would slaughter all the baby boys in an attempt to hang on to his throne. Sound familiar? But unlike Moses, Jesus was willing to do what had to be done in order to save those who could not save themselves. Unlike Moses, whilst Jesus is 100% human, he's also 100% God. And this brings us to our final point, that God himself rescues. The thing that Moses needs to focus on and that we need to grasp is that God is not issuing orders from on high. I find that often in life I have to deal with people who just are having the most awful day because they're trying to carry something out that they've been told to do from head office. And it's just impossible, or it makes their life very difficult. And obviously the instruction that's come from head office is from someone who's never ever worked, you know, on the front line of the call centre or at the checkout or in the warehouse. It's a great idea by someone who's wearing a suit somewhere but has no idea how it works in practice. Maybe you've been on the receiving end of that. Maybe, you know, you've had to implement something and you thought, this just does not work. God's not like that. In Exodus chapter 3 verse 8, God tells Moses, "So, I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey." God doesn't just send Moses, he's also going to come down to do the actual work of salvation himself. No other religion is like that. All other religions rely on us doing all the hard work, being as good as we can be, becoming better, reaching up to God, trying harder, being exalted, and then rewarded for our efforts. Yahweh is realistic. Our efforts are never going to be good enough to put us on a level with a truly holy God. We can't climb up to him. If we're to be saved and rescued, he must come down to us. And because God is I am, the one and only God, he's able to defeat the most powerful of enemies. Pharaoh won't stand in his way, and sin and death's days are numbered too. How? Have you ever wondered why, in John's Gospel, when Jesus is arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, the guards fall to the ground in response to Jesus simply answering a question from them? Let me remind you. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went and asked them, "Who do you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I am he," Jesus said, and Judas the traitor was standing there with them. When Jesus said, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. That's weird behaviour, isn't it? I mean, it's not like Jesus was sort of a dangerous, violent criminal. It's not like sort of, you know, he's Putin on the run or something, or the Hulk from the Marvel movies or comics. Why did the guards draw back and fall to the ground when he simply announced who he was? Because these are the temple guards. They're not the Roman soldiers, they're the Jewish guards. They know their scriptures, and Jesus has just announced, "I am he." Jesus has declared that he is Yahweh. As Jesus prepares to go to the cross to save God's people from slavery to sin and death, we are meant to connect the dots and draw the line right back here to Exodus and see again in Jesus, God has come down to save. As we continue our journey through Lent, we're reminded that when we read the Old Testament, we see God showing what he's going to do in the New Testament. So in the Exodus, we look ahead, we see a picture of how God is going to come down and save his people from the worst slave master, sin, who brings only suffering and death to all those under his power. We are all slaves to sin. But God will keep his promise to Abraham, and he will bless all peoples of all nations through the offspring of that one man. Jesus will appear to be weak and helpless, but he will be. He is Emmanuel, God with us, God for us, our rescuer, our redeemer, and our saviour. Amen.